David Mitchell, The Bone Clocks, 2014. On the July day that I sat down to write a review of a novel due to be published in September, I learned that it had just been nominated for the Man Booker Award. This rather took the wind out of my sails. I felt as if I should say, "Bound for Glory," and leave it at that. Certainly the book invites the prediction. In its almost 600 pages of metafictional shenanigans in relentlessly brilliant prose, The Bone Clocks hits lots of hot buttons, from the horrors of the Iraq War to the eternal battle of good and evil to the near future downfall of our civilization. It aims unerringly and from many directions at success. At one point, it even reviews itself, and the temptation to quote is irresistible. 1. The author is so bent on avoiding cliché that each sentence is as tortured as an American whistleblower. 2. The fantasy subplot clashes so violently with the book's state-of-the-world pretensions, I cannot bear to look. 3. What surer sign is there that the creative aquifers are running dry than a writer creating a writer character? The review is too nasty to be just, but its self-protective mockery does provide a good example of an outstanding quality of the book, self-consciousness. In its vast inventiveness, its exploitation of trendy pop-cult stereotypes, soul-sucking vampires, anyone? Its jaunty hops between holocausts. The novel reminded me of Michael Chabon's Cavalier in Clay and the Yiddish Policeman's Union. But where Chabon is genuinely freewheeling, Mitchell's daring is somehow anxious. He watches his steps, always. Reading Chabon, I'm carefree. Reading Mitchell, I feel cautious, uncertain. The story is narrated in the first person by 5 very different voices, at 6 different times from 1984 to 2043. Among them, a 15-year-old girl writing in the general tone of a young adult thriller, a consummately self-parodic prick, whose first novel was called Desiccated Embryos, writing in Anglo-Mandarin, and a semi-immortal body shifter. I find these radical shifts of time and person difficult, and though willing to suspend disbelief, am uncertain when to do so. Am I to believe in the hocus-pocus of the secret cult of the blind Cathar in the same way I am to believe in the realistic portrayal of the death agonies of corporate capitalism? Or should I believe in them in different ways? But what does it matter? It's just a novel, isn't it? Well, maybe. But how many novels is it? Maybe it's one, and I just don't see how it hangs together. Or maybe it's not hanging together is the point, and I don't get it. There you are. Anxiety in the writer makes the reader anxious, too. In its temporal leaps, and in that the narration is stream of consciousness or stream of self-consciousness, The Bone Clocks can be compared to Woolf's The Years and The Waves. But The Years is told in the past tense, and the voices that tell the waves are always framed by it. Ginny said, Lewis said. In The Bone Clocks, a novel deeply concerned with time, there is virtually no past tense. Present tense narration is now taken for granted by many fiction readers because everything they read, from internet news to texting, is in the present tense. But at this great length, it can be hard going. Past tense narration easily implies previous times and extends into the vast misty reaches of the subjunctive, the conditional, the future. But the pretense of a continuous eyewitness account admits little relativity of times, little connection between events. The present tense is a narrow beam flashlight in the dark, limiting the view to the next step. Now, now, now. No past, no future. The world of the infant, of the animal, perhaps of the immortal. while learning how it is that some of the characters are indeed more or less immortal, we get a glimpse of a scene that to me stands out in silence from the jangle of dazzle language and the kaleidoscopic tumult of brilliant imagery and filmic cliché. We see it again just before an extended climactic orgy of violence. Nothing in the plot appears to depend directly on this vision or refer back to it. Yet I came away from the book with the sense that it is the center, the still center, of all the frenetic action. "The dusk," says Arkady, "between life and death. We see it from the high ridge. It's a beautiful, fearsome sight. All the souls, the pale lights, crossing over, blown by the seaward wind to the last sea, which, of course, isn't really a sea at all." A west window offers a view over 1 mile or 100 miles of dunes, up to the high ridge and the light of day. Holly follows me. "See up there?" I tell her. "That's where we're from." "Then all those little pale lights," whispers Holly, "crossing the sand? Their souls?" "Yes, thousands and thousands at any given time." We walk over to the eastern window, where an inexact distance of dunes rolls down through darkening twilight to the last sea. "And that's where they're bound." We watch the little lights enter the starless extremity and go out, one by one by one. Sketchy as it is, this has to me the quality of a true vision. For all the stuff and nonsense about escaping mortality by switching bodies and devouring souls, death is at the heart of this novel, and there lies its depth and darkness, bravely concealed by all the wit and sleight of word and ventriloquistic verbiage and tale-telling bravura of which David Mitchell is a master. Whatever prizes it wins or doesn't, The Bone Clocks will be a great success, and it deserves to be, because a great many people will enjoy reading it very much, even if I'm not quite sure what it's all about. I know it's a whopper of a story. And in it, under all the klaxons and saxophones and Irish fiddles, is that hidden, haunting silence at the center. Behind the dazzle of narrative fireworks and verbal Klieg lights is the shadow that maybe makes it true.